Mastercard Business Bonus sichern Sie sich attraktive Rabatte auf Tools und Services für Ihr Unternehmen. Alle Angebote unter mastercard.com/businessbonus.
Persil sorgt schon seit 1907 für tiefenreine Wäsche, auch bei den Johnsons, oder Anna?
Das stimmt. Sogar meine Oma hat schon mit Persil gewaschen.
Und als Dankeschön für über 100 Jahre Vertrauen gibt's jetzt bis zu 15 Euro Rabatt auf unser Bestes.
Das mit der roten Schleife.
Genau, made in Germany. Mehr Infos auf unserbestes.persil.de.
Wenn es tiefenrein ist, ist es Persil.
Welcome to the Richard Serrett Show. Coming up, the Waterloo Region District School Board's woke manifesto calling our nation a criminal enterprise built on stolen land and genocide. I'll tear it apart with the truth. Plus, the explosive Sean Diddy Combs verdict, not guilty on racketeering and sex trafficking, but guilty on prostitution charges. Is this justice or a courtroom circus? We'll unpack it with America's psychiatrist, Dr. Carol Lieberman, who dives into the psyche behind the headlines. The Richard Serrett Show, off and running for Wednesday, July the 2nd, in the year of our Lord, 2025. Facta, non verba.
I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
We must not allow ourselves to be intimidated. Our task is not only to win the battle, but to win the war.
I'm feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Take a look at this country through her eyes if you really want to see something. You'll see the whole parade of what man's carved out for himself after centuries of fighting.
You're out of order! You're out of order! The whole trial is out of order!
You have meddled with the primal forces of nature! And you will atone!
Seeking truth and justice in a battleground of deception and corruption, this is The Richard Serrett Show.
Welcome to The Richard Serrett Show. The Waterloo Region District School Board's Canada Day message for 2025 is a vile, insidious attack on our nation's soul, a cowardly surrender to the woke mob that seeks to paint Canada as a criminal enterprise founded on theft and genocide. Their words, dripping with sanctimonious guilt, are not an invitation to reflect, but a command to grovel, to renounce our heritage, and to embrace a revisionist history that casts every non-Indigenous Canadian as a villain. I'm here to shred this nonsense with a sharp blade of truth, to defend Canada's honor, and to expose the lies of stolen land, cultural genocide, and the grotesque myth of murdered Indigenous children buried in mass graves. Canada is not an evil nation. It is a triumph of human resilience, and no school board's woke drivel will convince me otherwise. Now, here's what the Waterloo Region District School Board had the audacity to say. Quote, as we prepare to acknowledge July 1st as Canada Day, we celebrate and we reflect. We also encourage those of us who are settlers of this nation to take this opportunity to learn about Turtle Island, embrace the hard truths of our history, and make a personal commitment towards reconciliation. We have a responsibility to understand our country's history and become aware of the Indigenous roots on which it was built. Together, let's take that understanding and create a better future for all based on peace, friendship, and respect, and the upholding of treaty rights of Indigenous peoples, the first peoples of this land. This is not a message of unity. It's a manifesto of division, a call to dismantle Canada's identity and replace it with a fictional narrative of shame. The phrase, settlers of this nation, is a loaded weapon, branding every non-Indigenous Canadian as an interloper, a thief squatting on stolen land. The term, Turtle Island, is even more insidious, a modern romanticized invention that erases the complex history of pre-contact North America to serve a woke agenda. Before Europeans arrived, this continent was not a unified indigenous paradise. It was a vast, sparsely populated land of hundreds of tribes, Algonquin, Iroquois, Cree, Blackfoot, and more, each with distinct languages, cultures, and histories. They traded, allied, and fought with one another, just as nations everywhere have done for millennia. The Haida raided coastal tribes. The Iroquois waged war against the Huron. To pretend they were a monolithic turtle island is to strip them of their agency and reduce their history to a simplistic fairy tale. The claim that Canada is stolen land is equally dishonest. When Europeans, French, British, and others arrived, they didn't encounter a single nation to plunder. They found a dynamic landscape where survival demanded negotiation, cooperation, and yes, conflict. Treaties like the numbered treaties of the 19th century or the earlier peace and friendship treaties were often mutual agreements, not unilateral theft. The Royal Proclamation of 1763, issued by King George III, recognized indigenous land rights and established a framework for negotiations, a concept far ahead of its time compared to the Spanish or Portuguese empires. Were these treaties always honored? No. Were they sometimes exploitative? Yes. But to portray them as mere tools of dispossession ignores the agency of indigenous leaders who negotiated them, securing trade goods, military alliances, or protection against rival tribes. The land was not stolen in some grand heist. It was transferred, often imperfectly, through centuries of complex interactions. The settlers themselves, those the school board vilifies, were not colonial masterminds, but ordinary people. Farmers, laborers, families fleeing famine in Ireland or persecution in Scotland. They faced brutal winters, disease, and starvation to build homes, schools, and roads. They didn't come to steal, but to survive. To cast them and their descendants as criminals is not just unfair, it's a deliberate attempt to fracture our national identity. Canada's story is one of convergence. Indigenous peoples, European settlers, and later immigrants from Asia, Africa, and beyond built a nation that stands as a global beacon of freedom and prosperity. To reduce it to stolen land is to spit on their sacrifices. Now, let's confront the most poisonous lie, the claim of cultural genocide, and the narrative that Indigenous children were murdered or went missing at residential schools, buried in mass graves. This is the emotional cudgel of the woke agenda, and it's built on distortion and exaggeration. The residential school system, established in the 19th century, was a flawed attempt to assimilate Indigenous children through education, rooted in the era's paternalistic belief that Western ways were superior. Children were often removed from families, and some schools suppressed Indigenous languages and traditions. This was wrong. And the consequences, cultural loss, trauma, neglect, were real and tragic. But cultural genocide? That's a term coined in the 21st century, retroactively applied to inflame emotions. Genocide implies intent to exterminate a people, as seen in the Holocaust or the Rwandan genocide. Residential schools, however misguided, were not death camps. Many were run by churches, not state executioners, and some Indigenous parents supported them, seeing education as a path to opportunity. The claim of murdered children in mass graves is even more egregious. In 2021, reports of unmarked graves at sites like Kamloops sparked a frenzy, with activists and media implying hundreds of children were killed and buried in secret. The Waterloo Region District School Board's call to embrace the hard truths leans into this narrative. But what's the evidence? Ground-penetrating radar found soil anomalies, potential burial sites, but no bodies have been conclusively identified as murder victims. Historical records show many deaths at residential schools were due to diseases like tuberculosis, which killed Indigenous and non-Indigenous Canadians alike in staggering numbers before modern medicine. These children were often buried in school cemeteries, not mass graves, a term that conjures images of Nazi atrocities. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission's 2015 report, after exhaustive research, found no evidence of systemic murder or cover-ups. Yet the myth persists, fueled by emotion, not facts, poisoning our national discourse. This is not to dismiss the pain of residential school survivors. Their stories are real, their suffering undeniable. Canada must address their needs. Clean water, better schools, economic opportunity. But to weaponize their pain, to paint Canada as a genocidal state, is to exploit them for ideological ends. It divides us, casting Indigenous Canadians as perpetual victims and non-Indigenous Canadians as perpetual villains. That's not reconciliation. It's resentment. Canada is not evil. It's a nation that fought tyranny in two world wars, built a transcontinental railway against impossible odds, and welcomed millions from every corner of the globe. Its institutions, parliaments, courts, universities, are the envy of the world. Its people, Indigenous and non-Indigenous, have created a society where freedom, law, and opportunity thrive. The Waterloo Region District School Board's message is a betrayal of this legacy, a demand that we trade pride for guilt, unity for division. I say no. We're not settlers. We're not thieves. We are Canadians. And our history is one of resilience, not shame. I hope that on Canada Day you celebrated the true North, strong and free, and rejected the woke lies that seek to tear it down. Coming up next, Diddy walks free on RICO and sex trafficking, but guilty on prostitution charges. Was the jury rushed for Independence Day? Join Dr. Carol Lieberman, America's psychiatrist, as we unpack the verdict's psyche on The Richard Serrett Show. Welcome back. Sean Diddy Combs dodged a legal bullet in a Manhattan federal court, acquitted of racketeering, conspiracy, and sex trafficking charges that could have meant life behind bars. The jury, after 13 hours of deliberation, convicted him on two counts of transportation for prostitution, each carrying up to 10 years. Was the verdict rushed for Independence Day festivities, or did the prosecution overreach? Here to unpack the psyche behind this high-profile case is Dr. Carol Lieberman, America's psychiatrist, host of Dr. Carol's Couch and the Terrorist Therapist podcast, and author of the award-winning Lions and Tigers and Terrorists, Oh My. She's here to analyze what drove this verdict and what it reveals about justice today. Dr. Carol, welcome back to The Richard Serrett Show. How are you?
Thank you very much. I am furious.
Yeah, I think a lot of people share that that sentiment. But as a forensic psychiatrist, what psychological factors do you think influenced the jury's decision to acquit Diddy on the racketeering and sex trafficking charges, but convict him on the prostitution-related counts?
I think that they were trying to not let him off completely, but they didn't want to give him a charge that could put him in life, you know, for prison, for life, put him in jail for life. See, I'm so upset about this. I think, you know, when this trial began, I said I was worried about two things. I was worried that he could get off lightly because of two reasons. One was because, you know, he has all this money and all these connections. And how hard would it be since the jury wasn't sequestered, how hard would it be to reach one of the jury members and, you know, give them some money or give them a promise or something? And then also I thought maybe some jury members will think, well, we don't want the law enforcement or the judiciary to tell us what we can and can't do in our bedrooms. So you know, we don't want to give them a lot of punishment, a lot of years in prison and so on, because that would give the courts more access, more of a feeling that they can rule on what we do for sex. And then I think, and the other part was, I really think that in a couple of things, how we have to change the judicial system. One, juries need to be sequestered for high profile cases. We have seen this time and time again, starting with George Floyd. Right. You know, the jury wasn't sequestered. They saw all these mobs of people out front. You know, yes, I know. I think they were taken by a bus or whatever to behind the courthouse, but they saw, they knew. And then Karen Reed with all the people carrying signs, free Karen Reed. And I think that there is a lot of influence of, if they are not sequestered. Plus, you know, they're not supposed to be watching television or looking at the internet, listening to the radio, any media, and not supposed to be listening to their friends. But, you know, I have a feeling, especially, I mean, the Diddy trial was long. It was about 8 weeks. And that's a long time to not do any of these things. So I find it hard to believe that they weren't influenced in some way by something outside. But also, you know, I'm like, really, you know, I've been watching not only the Diddy trial, but I watched also right after that was Koberger, the plea. And that was very upsetting too. But, I know what I was gonna say. There needs to be better voir dire. The part of the trial, the beginning of the trial, where the attorneys have a chance to question the potential jurors. Now, there have been cases where jurors want to get on, especially a famous case, you know, because, oh, just for the you know, bragging rights after, for being able to write a book about it, for being able to go on television talking about it, all these things. And some to be able to influence the outcome, the verdict. And so I think all of these problems were there. And, you know, there was this question of juror 25. The first note that the jury sent out was that they have a problem that juror 25 can't follow the judge's instructions. Now, juror 25 was this middle-aged man who was a scientist. You know, he had a degree, a doctorate, I think it was a PhD in science. And so it wasn't that he didn't understand, that he couldn't understand the language, although, you know, jury instructions are oftentimes written a little, you know, it's complicated. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that was the issue. So we don't really know what the issue was. But suddenly the judge said, go back and go back and keep deliberating. Well, what changed with juror 25, you know? Why all of a sudden now was he able to make a decision? Was he able to understand or be able to follow the judge's instructions? What happened that made him follow them?
Right.
And I do think, just to end, I do think that that there were other jurors too, like they weren't all in agreement from the beginning, in addition to 25. And I think that today, you know, what made them sort of some of the holdouts give up their position was because, yeah, they wanted to get away for the July 4th weekend.
Yeah, well, the jury deliberated for, 13 hours before reaching the verdict. Do you believe this suggests, I was going to ask you, suggests a rush decision, possibly influenced by the timing of July 4th, Independence Day, or does it? Maybe some might argue it reflects careful consideration of the evidence.
Well, this was a very complicated, there were complicated charges. And I don't think, you know, I'm not saying, I think if you ask the jurors, none of them would say, oh yeah, we wanted to get away for July 4th. But, you know, 13 hours to contemplate these complicated charges, like for example, some attorneys have been saying that RICO charges are very complicated in themselves, you know, even that one charge. So, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how they could come up with this verdict. I think someone, you know, gave in. They got tired arguing.
Einsteigen, aufdrehen, losfahren. Mit dem neuen Volkswagen T-Roc bist du bereit für den großen Auftritt. Selbstbewusst und voller Power. Du steigst ein? Keine Kompromisse. Nur du und der Moment. Alles passt. Dein Sound, dein Drive, dein T-Roc. Rockt. Der neue T-Roc.
Lust auf besonders feine Weihnachten? Erlebe einzigartigen Genuss mit Rewe Feine Welt. Diese Woche zum Beispiel Rewe Feine Welt Schweizer Käse Trüffeltraum mildwürzig, je 150 Gramm Packung, nur 3,49 Euro. Oder Rewe Feine Welt italienischer Prosciutto Crudo, roher Schinken mit Meersalz behandelt, mindestens 18 Monate gereift, je 100 Gramm Packung nur 4,29 Euro. Festlich sparen mit Genuss. Rewe, dein Markt.
Achtung, es folgt eine wichtige Botschaft Ihres Mobilfunkanbieters.
Ey Mann, es gibt Leute, die drücken immer noch zu viel Knitter ab.
Nein, nicht frisch.
Ein Barra ist der irgendwie smarter.
Ja, smart.
50 Gigabyte für nur 8,99.
Wenig Knete.
Ich zahle doch nicht mehr für weniger.
Nee, das wäre auch schön blöd. Barra, deine Knete, deine Entscheidung.
Nice.
Alle Details zu unseren Tarifen finden Sie unter libara.de.
Well, how do you think Diddy's public persona as, you know, this music mogul, celebrity, how did that impact the jury's perception of his guilt or innocence, either consciously or unconsciously?
A lot of times, you know, celebrities get celebrity justice, which is not the same justice that we get. It can work both ways. Like, there could be people on the jury who don't like his music, but there's still a sense of celebrity. And he was playing to the jury. God, you know, he was smiling at the jury, and he told the judge at one point, you did a good job. I mean, he was so arrogant at the beginning. And then when the jury came back and said that they are in agreement on four of the five charges, and then he kind of, it dawned on him that maybe he's not going to get off scot-free, that maybe there's something that he is going to get a guilty verdict on, because then he wasn't so arrogant. Like this morning, I mean, this was all an act too, but this morning he came in supposedly praying, you know, I mean, he was playing the jury. He was doing his shtick, his star shtick. It is just so sad, you know, when you think about, and those poor women, Cassie Ventura.
Cassie. I mean, yeah, they had the testimony from Cassie, surveillance footage of Diddy's violent behavior. Why do you think the jury didn't find this sufficient to convict on the more serious charges?
Well, it's very interesting. I think a lot of it had to do with, that they found these texts. The problem was that these women, even Jane also, you know, that was her pseudonym, Jane, they were in this very confused relationship with Diddy. I mean, on the one hand, they didn't want to do the freakouts. They hated the freakouts. It was demeaning and you could tell from Cassie's testimony and all that, I mean, and Jane too, that this was talking about, it was just bringing up all these horrible traumatic memories, and yet at the same time they loved Diddy. You know, I mean, it's like, why girls go with abusive men, why women stay with abusive men? Because, you know, the men keep apologizing. Well, in Diddy's case, he also was threatening, you know, he threatened her parents. I mean, I don't know how she could go back to him after he made her parents pay him $20,000, and they didn't have, you know, a ton of money. I think they had to mortgage get a second mortgage on their house or something like that. How do you go back to somebody who does that to your parents? That part I don't understand. But, and the thing was, there were eight men and four women, but a lot of times women are harsher on women, and sometimes they can't understand, you know, well, why did she keep going back? She didn't have to go back. He didn't imprison them. But it's this very strong, and then you look at the Cassie videotape of him beating her up, and you think, why would this woman go back to him? But she was mesmerized. You know, that's the thing. He had them mesmerized. Also, of course, Cassie wanted help with her career, her music career. And I don't know about whether Jane was expecting that kind of thing or not. But you know, he has a very powerful presence, a very seductive presence. And also to be the girlfriend of P. Diddy, you know, you go to these parties and you get walk red carpets and, you know, it's very seductive, all of this.
From a psychological perspective, you mentioned Diddy's, you know, praying in courtroom, and he was also mouthing, I think, "I'm coming home" after the verdict was announced. I mean, how, as a psychologist, how do you interpret that?
I'll interpret it as a psychiatrist. Psychiatrist.
Yes, psychiatrist. My apologies. Yes. Yes. Sorry.
Okay. People keep doing that. And it, how do I interpret his doing those things that you mentioned? Well, you know, I mean, I think at the beginning he was cocky, and he was trying to act like there's no way you're going to find me guilty, to sort of convince the jury, you know, act casual, smiling at them and all that, like he's relaxed, you know, you're not going to find me guilty. He also had this multi-million dollar law team on his behalf. And so he was trying to give that impression. And it only broke yesterday when he started realizing that he actually could get jail for something. But, you know, that's him. Like, he has this bravado. And he, you know, smiling to the jury. Like rules don't he doesn't have to go by the rules, is what he feels. You know, yes, defendants aren't supposed to do those kinds of things. In fact, the judge, at least on one occasion, scolded him for looking at the jury so much and all that. But so he, you know, he's above all that. Now, the interesting part, well, it's all interesting. You know, at the beginning, I thought this whole thing was just disgusting, and I wasn't going to pay any attention to the trial because this is ridiculous. You know, this is, it's just gross. But then, of course, you know, everybody wanted to know about things about the trial. So I ended up talking about it, but and watching it, well, watching people talk about it. I mean, the media, the cameras weren't allowed in the courtroom. But what the thing that I did find really interesting is that it turns out that his mother, well, first of all, his father died when he was 3. His father was into drugs. I mean, into selling drugs, into the drug trade, and, you know, hobnob with big drug kingpins, which is rather dangerous. So he got shot when Diddy was 3. And so he grew up with his mother and his grandmother. And his mother, they started out in Harlem, and then they moved further north. I don't know if that was because of a life insurance policy. I don't know how they had the money to do that, but that's not really important. What's important is that the mother kept inviting her friends from Harlem up to their Westchester, it was around Westchester, home on weekends. And they had these parties, which were essentially pre-freak-offs. She invited whores, prostitutes, and pimps, and there was sex, and there was nudity, and there was alcohol, and there was drugs. You know, she had these parties every weekend, and this is what he went through during his childhood. So it's no wonder that when he got to be older and could afford to make these same kind of parties, but on a grand scale, that he did it. Did it.
was she like? Okay, it doesn't excuse anything that he did later, of course.
Absolutely not.
But was she grooming him, or was she just clueless and reckless?
Well, I think, first of all, that there is an incestuous relationship between Diddy and his mother. I don't know for a fact that it was physically incestuous. It was certainly emotionally incestuous. But can't you even say that it was physically incestuous in a sense? Because here she was having sex right in front of him, you know, at these parties, naked and all of that. And he's there watching. I mean, you know, that's exposing yourself. I mean, that's, you know, now did she know? I don't think she cared, you know? I don't think she thought about, is this going to harm him, harm his little psyche for later on? I think she just was having fun and she didn't care.
So again, as America's psychiatrist, what does this verdict reveal about the broader cultural psychological dynamics of justice and celebrity and accountability in today's society.
It's very shaky. It's not, you know, that's I'm bothered by this whole verdict, not just because it seems unfair, but because as an expert witness, a forensic psychiatrist, it's very demoralizing to think, you know, that my work is for nothing. I mean, granted, in my cases, I'm proud to say, happy to say, that the jury usually goes the way that I'm, you know, that I explain it, because I explain it, I start back from when the defendant was, you know, a child, or even before, when what genes he inherited and so on. And so I put the jury in the shoes of the defendant. Or when it's a civil case, you know, I do the same kind of thing. I get very psychological and get them to understand whatever side I'm on. But you know, it's demoralizing to think that that standards are just falling down, kind of like they are in other ways in our society. Like you know, you used to dress to go to theater on Broadway and restaurants, and you know, used to have better language, be more concerned about your language. Now everything is four letters. I mean, you know, we've kind of gotten very lazy, very letting everything go, and it's not good.
Dr. Carol Lieberman, America's psychiatrist. How do we watch Dr. Carol's Couch, and how do we listen to the Terrorist Therapist podcast?
Dr. Carol's Couch is actually also a podcast, or it was a radio show. Now it's a podcast. Everything's going podcast. That's on voiceamerica.com. And the Terrorist Therapist podcast, and it's also not just on Voice America. That's where I do it, but it's on wherever you get podcasts. Same thing with Terrorist Therapist. It's on the website of renegadetalkradio.com. But it's also wherever you get podcasts.
Fantastic. Dr. Carol Lieberman, thank you as always. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
All right, that's it for me. I'll speak with you again real soon. In the meantime, I remain unbowed, unbent, unbroken.